Welcome to Season 10, Episode 10 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we decide to discuss, does canon actually matter? Again, welcome to Season 10, Episode 10 of RPG Circus. My name, of course, is Jeff, and joining me this episode is Christian Ish. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, should be exciting. As I just said before on the pre-show, this is a double-edged sword topic.
Yes, it is. And that's part of the fun.
And yes, people, there are such things as double-edged swords. Not every sword has I don't know. I always love that. I don't know what the hell I was watching. I was watching something stupid one time. It was like a cartoon. The double-edged dagger! Last time I checked, most daggers were double-edged, so I don't get the... I don't know. Sorry, I digress.
All right. Worries. Rabo dares to be different.
Yep.
That's a big blade. I don't consider that quite a dagger. It's like a Bowie knife. You know? It's just... I don't know. It's like everything else. It's like, what is this? It's kind of a knife. It's a sword. It's, you know, it's whatever you want it, you know. Because even, let's face it, even the term short sword isn't quite an actual term. It's something we invented.
Right.
Yes, that's true.
So it's just like...
Well, and I'm sure that somewhere out there, there is an expert on weapons where we could have a whole episode just on, like, double-edged, single-edged, daggers, short swords... Gladii, what have you.
Yeah, you know, and I think, trust me, that's a whole topic into itself, how we get caught in the minutiae sometimes. It's cool, because it's like, hey, it kind of fleshes out what we're trying to describe, but on the other hand, it gets kind of, gets really wacky after a while.
Oh, yeah.
So, all right, so let's go with a little news, which you threw up here, which was, of course, the Origins actually released, where am I here? There we go. Nope, that's the wrong one. There it is. Origins Game Fair actually released their nominees for RPG games and supplements. So I'm just going to go through it real quick.
Sure.
For RPGs, it was the Role-Playing Game Adventures in Middle-Earth Player's Handbook.
Nice.
From Cubicle 7. Blades in the Dark by Evil Hat Productions. I'm not familiar with that. What's the setting for that? Do you know? What's the concept?
Basically, this idea of running your own Thieves Guild in a story arc, and you can pick basically what, you know, era and scenario you do at this point. And you basically have a group that's interconnected, but obviously part of the underworld.
Huh. That's kind of cool. Okay.
It is.
Next we have Blue Rose by Green Ronin Publishing. Not familiar with that one either?
I am. I remember familiar with the original product. It was an attempt to make a D20 product originally for a romantic campaign, hence the Blue Rose.
Huh.
And now I'm intrigued to see if it made this far.
You know, that's interesting. I wonder if that... I remember going to a small convention locally, and there was some sort of... I don't even want to... It was almost like some sort of live-action role-playing game that somebody was playing that was a little more set. I think it was geared more towards women. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember exactly. And that almost sounds like something that it would be. I'm not trying to be... I don't know. That sounds bad. Anyway, let's go on to the next one before I dig myself a further hole. We have Cthulhu Confidential by Pelagon Press. The Dark Eye Core Rules by... I can't pronounce that.
I guess in Ulysses, spelled with a I instead of a Y, but that's just a guess.
Ulysses Spiel, okay. I'm guessing German company, probably?
Yeah.
We have The Extraordinary Adventures of Baron Munchausen by Fantasy Flight Games. Oh, God. My Little Pony. By River Horse Limited. Okay. You know what? Who am I to say? I actually know a few bronies, unfortunately. Monster Hearts 2 by Buried Without Ceremony. Puppet Land.
Huh.
I'm sorry. You're gonna say
Monster Hearts is one of those games that I admire the man for making it, but I don't know if I could ever play it. And seeing as we just mentioned both My Little Ponies and Blue Rose, that should tell you where the bar is.
So next we have Puppet Land by Arc Dream Publishing, Starfinder by Paizo, the Traveler Starter Set by Mongoose Publishing, and Vert by Raven Desk Games. What the hell's Vert? Do you know?
I have no idea.
No, no, nor do I.
All right, we have a winner.
Yay!
All right, let's just get into the role-playing supplements. We have role-playing supplements. We have Adventures in Middle-Earth, the Rohaven Region Guide, and then the Adventures in Middle-Earth Lore Master's Guide. Wow, there's quite a few that have two. That's mm-hmm. no, you know, the only thing I don't like about that when that happens is that means you're fighting against yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at least that's, I don't know how it works on this, but that's definitely how it works in the Annies. Blue Rose, Narrator's Kit. Call of Cthulhu, the Grand Grimoire of Cthulhu Mythos. Call of Cthulhu, the Two-Headed Serpent. Castles and Crusades Codex, Germania. Castles and Crusades Codex, Slavorium. Okay. Cypher Worlds Expanded by Monty Cook. Cypher Worlds, is that Prediction? Predation, sorry. God, I can't pronounce anything. The Doctor Who's RPG Game Master's Companion. The Dungeons & Dragons Xanthar's Guide to Everything.
Oh my, Stars and Garters. I think it's been like 2 years since one of them has been mentioned on this topic. You know, D&D kind of had a bit of a hiatus there for about a year and a half. Yeah. The last couple of innings. Fourth Regions.
Mutants and Masterminds Atlas of Earth Prime. And the Shadow of the Demon, Demon Lord's Companion. All right.
Some very stiff competition, to put it mildly. Like, it's actually, you know, I kid about a lot of the things, some, you know.
Yeah.
But honestly, quality's improved over the years.
And so the winners will be announced June 16th of this year. So I guess we'll see. I'm actually curious who's going to actually win the RPG one. There's some mm-hmm. There's some interesting choices, to say the least.
Oh, indeed. What else can I say? Just
wow.
Let
okay.
this game win.
Yeah.
Sorry if I interrupted. Go on.
No. That's just quite a list. Like I said, it'll be very interesting to see who wins. And I don't know. Actually, no. I never really. That's one thing. Of all the years that I've done Guess the Ennies, I've never used any type of origin winners to guess who might win the Ennies. Because didn't the I forget when the Ennie voting happens. Does Ennie voting happen before or after? Yeah, you know.
I think it's after. Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, all the nominees are in by now, but the actual voting, I think, happened. It happened shortly before Gen Con. Because we always do guess the Ennies after the voting is closed. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes sense. See, I'm not paying attention too much these days. Guessing the Ennies is fun. Yeah, I guess winning an Ennie is fun, but I don't attach a lot of weight to it.
That's fair.
All right. So let's get on with the topic. Let's talk about canon. And we're talking about canon, not like the missile version of a cannon, not like an explosive cannon.
And this can come in a later episode.
Full broadside, yes.
Exactly.
By the way, I have mm-hmm. actually seen the old Missouri do a full broadside.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Yeah, that was very interesting because you can feel the concussion blast, and they're 2,000 yards away.
Yeah.
They actually move in the water, too, to the side, like by 2 or 3 feet or something bizarre like that.
I bet.
Or at least they did when they were, obviously, it was still in service.
Mm-hmm.
That ship actually got mothballed 3 times.
Huh.
It got commissioned during World War II, got mothballed, saw action in Vietnam, got mothballed. Saw action in the First Gulf War and got mothballed again, I think. I don't know if it's actually still a mothball. But, and they definitely don't build them like that, and it still had, if you look at the actual as they say, the hours on the hull, still a very low hour frame compared to the other vessels. That's why they kept pulling it out of mothballs. It was cheap.
Makes sense.
All right, but let's get back to what we're talking about, which is cannons. I can tell sea stories later.
Fair enough. Well, the reason I brought it up is because another podcaster who I really enjoy his work, his name is Jim Ryan. His website is www.jim, decided to do canon for various different science fiction, ranging from Terry Pratchett to Doctor Who to the Marvel Universe and so forth. So I guess we better start with a basic definition of canon. I'm going to pull the Merriam-Webster Dictionary just for laughs. Regulation or dogma agreed by a church council, some I don't think it really applies, a provision of canon law. Authoritative list of folks accepted as Holy Scripture. Yeah, that's probably the closest. The authentic works of a writer. The sanctuary accepted by a group of body related works. Accepted principle or rule. In short, it's something that's considered suitable within the actual context of gaming. So I guess I will start by asking you guys, what do you think canon is?
Well, in typical RPGs, usually canon is, I've always viewed it as kind of the accepted norm of information, you know, or like specifically, a lot of times you see that in settings where this is the way that, you know, this is the canon for this setting. And a lot of times, especially if it's based on like some other literary work, it's usually the accepted translation for the game.
Okay. Makes sense to me. Ish, any thoughts for yourself?
No, that all seems to be fairly comprehensive.
Wow. Score one for me today.
Yay!
I'm not as big as idiot as I thought.
Yeah. No, we can argue about like specific genre canon. That all comes later. The definition of canon we can agree on.
Yeah.
Okay, agreed. So basically it's a whole bunch of books that people like and they go within there in this situation here. I guess... What do you consider? What is the one canon that you don't like deviating from your own experiences? You know, across any game, any situation, and so forth. Like, what becomes your own personal scripture when it comes to gaming? Like, is there certain settings that you go, you know, I have a lot more wiggle room, but sometimes, but if you go too far, I start feeling, I don't know, queasy?
Oh, I would have to say Traveler is the big one for me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's like the, in terms of, in many ways, that's kind of the granddaddy of them all. I mean, in terms of gaming, in a way. But Traveler is very unique in a lot of ways, and we can get into that later.
Definitely. Ish, same question, I guess?
Yeah, for me, I'm going to say the Forgotten Realms. It's not as though I have this idea in my head of how it's supposed to be and can't deviate from it, but I have run into enough players, like almost always, at least in one Forgotten Realms campaign that I'm running, there's someone who knows it better than I do, who's read every novel there is to read.
The encyclopedia.
Yeah, exactly. And so
I
worry so much about saying, oh, well, this person in Waterdeep, and then I'll say, no, that's a different person, or, you know, this doesn't exist in Forgotten Realms, or, you know, invariably someone will try and correct me on how things work in the Forgotten Realms. And so I have found myself needing to become an expert so that I can circumvent those issues.
Yeah.
And I'm not a big person on canon in general. There's some things that I will hold sacrosanct, and we can talk about that later. But, you know, for something like Forgotten Realms, if I have to invent whole new cities and remove whole new other ones, I don't have an issue with that. And in fact, that's been one of my go-tos, is if I have to shake down the world to change it enough where people can't guess and or pontificate about what should be there, then that's what I will do.
I would I was just thinking the other place that canon I think really gets to me, anything with a historical setting.
Oh god. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that gets really hard to deal with, because you're just like, it's like, yeah, I don't want to change it too much. And I think this is, again, I think I've said this before, people. It's like I like the idea of Deadlands, but I also don't like Deadlands because their setting, they've changed so much of what I would consider a historical West to be that as a game master, I can't run it.
I can understand that. In fact, that dovetails nicely into a little story. One of the greatest games I ever played actually was Deadlands, oddly enough, but it kind of died tragically, not because of the GM or the players of the thing. It was actually the official canon that kind of killed it. We ran through our party after playing through just about every section of the sun in the Tower of Doom trilogy. First two parts, not a single complaint in the world. But part three, we suddenly got relegated in the story to psychics.
Yeah, I hate that.
Like, Stone shows up, you know, that's that lumpy looking guy in the cover. Then another character shows up, and all this narrative happens without you being an active participant because they don't stat out their main villains, at least in the original classic Deadlands. And, well, it was fun going through the Devil's Tower, and they treated it like an alien encounter because they were trying to set up Hell on Earth. Hmm. You felt like you missed the big adventure. You know, the denouement, the big epic end.
Mm-hmm.
After interacting with Hellstrom, after interacting with Reverend Grimm, which basically all these iconic characters where you actually played off them. Then suddenly a character who basically shoots people dead and suddenly you're written around and suddenly you're just watching other people do stuff. And as soon as that happens, that broke the canon in my world.
Yeah. That's what you've described is if you were a game master not playing in something that's canon, where all of a sudden you have the GM's party.
You know,
the players, you have the GM's NPCs, and the players can't solve the problem by themselves. The GM NPCs, or the GMPC, if you will, solves mm-hmm. all the party's problems. And you're like, well, why the fuck am I here?
Exactly. Yeah. It's almost worse than that. Like, you couldn't even call it the GM's PCs or the GM's party. It's like the developer's PCs or the developer's party.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I'm just saying that's the closest equivalency.
Yeah, true. And I know White Wolf was really guilty of that with the World of Darkness back in the 90s. They would do that all the time, where you would go on some adventure with your vampire party, and all of a sudden, eight vampires that are all over 1,000 years old come together and fight or talk, and you're just kind of standing there like, you know, kids at an adult's dinner party and just watching cool stuff happen and having no effect on it whatsoever.
I'm sorry, I just started laughing when you said fight or talk. Oh yeah, that's exciting. No, I get it, but you know, I understand the concept of World of Darkness, and obviously you want to do more art role playing than probably combat, but it's just kind of funny. Oh, it was either fight or talk, and it just struck me funny. Sorry.
Yeah.
But no, I mean but you're right. That stuff, that's annoying. That kind of crap.
And no, yeah, you don't annoy your elders by pulling out the Trivial Pursuit board. Because, yeah, that's a story in itself, but you can definitely wait for another topic. So additionally, when it comes to official material, now we've entered a new area where there is a lot more canon that may be considered or such. Like, is a author who is paramount for the license, who basically wrote most of it, and then is somehow let go. Like, best example I can think of is E. Gary Gygax. D&D 2nd edition, he was booted up before it happened. But he's the father of gaming and the father of Dungeons & Dragons. Is he still considered canon in later editions, or is he just more of a homage figure?
Oh, that's a tough one. I mean, one of the things I've definitely learned is that almost every edition of a game ends up having its own canon, which usually completely disregards what happened prior. Because people, like you said, you know, obviously you're going to have a second edition. You're going to have new developers. They need to put their stamp on it to make it their own. And at that point, you do. You almost have different canon. I mean, Traveler had the same problem. You go from the classic Traveler to Mega Traveler to Traveler of the New Era to, you know, obviously the other edition of Traveler, including Mongoose, you know. It's sort of the same setting, but depends on who you are. And Traveler even has it worse, because there was GURPS Traveler that happened at the same time as Mega Traveler. And basically you have a split in the canon because, well, which one do you believe in? Do you believe Mega Traveler or do you believe GURPS Traveler? Or Mega Traveler, the rebellion happened, and in GURPS Traveler, no such thing.
Yep.
So, I mean, it is, but I mean, that's really what happens usually when a new game comes out, a new edition of a game. Someone's going to put a new stamp of approval. I mean, you can see it. I mean, people want to redesign things. They think, wouldn't it be cooler if it was this way? And so that does usually shift the canon. That's where usually a new edition of any supplement, that's usually what you'll see, is that something, and it might not even be completely fundamental, but there will be something in there that has changed the system enough or changed the setting enough that you're scratching your head like, this is not the system I remember, and I really don't like these changes. And there are other things you're going to be like, wow, that's cooler. I like that better.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, to quote Chinatown, the Big Trouble Little China, take what you want and leave the rest.
Yeah.
Great movie.
Oh, I love that movie. But no, that's, you know, I honestly think that we have passed the heyday of role players wanting setting books. And if you think back to like the early 2000s, late 90s, you had White Wolf and even Dungeons and Dragons and a couple of other places where they were shooting out setting books faster than you could buy them. And invariably someone would, like, you would have to get multiple writers on the project because they were just putting them out so quickly. And you would get all these contradictions and you would start to think, well, which one is right? Which writer has precedence? Like, what are we doing here? Because we're just kind of writing ourselves into this weird corner. And so that was an issue that I don't honestly think that we'll ever see again, because that was kind of this weird, I don't know what you would call it, silver age, I guess, for role-playing games. Yeah. But kind of the converse to that, and the example that I'll pull is Palladium Fantasy is, or not, I always call it Palladium. Palladium Books is where you have one guy who's basically in charge of all of the canon and really doesn't allow for any variation. And I think both those extremes don't serve their games well. Like, it's always good to have a line director who can make sure that everything is cohesive. And it's always good to have different voices in there, because once you start having one voice controlling the whole thing, it kind of, there's, you know, it doesn't have that spark anymore.
Yeah. No, you know, and it's also got to get into the, obviously, when you have that much canon material, you get those encyclopedia people that want to argue everything, you know, and it's just like, that's where it gets a little hard, because again, as a game master, you're going to take whatever the source material is and at a certain point you're like, yes, this is canon, but I don't quite like this, or heaven forbid, I didn't spend that additional $30 or $40 for that other supplement. So in my mind, that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's
exactly,
and that's the other thing is that, which is why I don't like encyclopedia people. It's like, it's cool that you're really interested in that, but you know, at the end of the day, it's like, for example, I love Star Trek.
Understandable.
What was it?
Understandable completely.
But I don't have an encyclopedia knowledge like some people. I'm not learning Klingon like some people are. you know,
I'll be blunt. One of these days, if we ever find somebody who speaks Klingon, I wouldn't mind having them on the show, even if it's just to do as a greeting.
Yeah.
Just to see for the sheer absurdity of it, and also the fact that,
strange and interesting fact, James Doohan originally wrote some of the original Klingon words.
Is there no depth to his skill set?
He was a maniac, honestly. I mean,
he's a person in real life that you wouldn't believe, you would think is fictional if you heard all the crap he's done.
Yeah, you know, he was at D-Day.
Yep.
Got his finger blown off. You know, which he hides throughout the series. He flew a plane, I think, after D-Day. He got into some program where he was flying planes, and he was known as a daredevil flyer. You know, and then he went and got then he went back to, because he's Canadian, if memory serves me right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he went back to Canada, and like he went to like a broadcasting school to, you know, after the war, and I'm like, that's just crazy, Doc. you know?
Apparently when he's bored, he makes languages up.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, yeah. the man was insane. And it's like, you know, it's always amazing. There's a lot, you know, everyone always says, well, why did I become an engineer? Because I like Scotty. You know? No, I mean, he was an amazing individual. I mean, even like anybody on Star Trek, it's like, you know, why did I get into computer programming? I like Spock.
Well, I think everybody did.
Yeah, well,
maybe there's exceptions, but it's the
exception. Here's the weird thing for me about Spock was, I always tell people, I said, why did I like Spock? Well, you know, he was smart, he was into computers, and honestly, in my opinion, all the really hot women wanted him. They didn't want Kirk. True. They wanted Spock. No, he was like, I don't do that, but, you know, hey, that's his problem, not mine.
And of course, he introduced the world to the sci-fi eyebrow raise.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So,
Speaking of Star Trek and canon, I mean, you just have to look at that line of the most recent Star Trek movies. What did they do? They almost literally blew up
They did.
The Star Trek canon. Mm-hmm. To kind of reset everything. They kind of did this, I don't even know how to describe it, but basically this kind of time paradox where it's like, okay, this is a parallel version of Star Trek. So none of the other things you know about Star Trek can apply from this point onwards. I want to say from the time that Kirk was a kid. So it just kind of washes everything away and we're like, okay, we're going to do this different now. Mm-hmm. So that was their way to approach the canon so that they couldn't get anyone saying, oh, that's not how it happened, which obviously is the kind of like the battle cry of the encyclopedia people.
Right. You know, yeah, that's said on the movies. First movie, not too bad. Second movie, eh. Third movie, not so bad.
Yeah. Exactly. Like, I think the biggest problem is they put themselves up against Wrath of Khan, and let's be honest, that's a high bar.
Yeah,
I could go all night about that. I was not happy with that.
Don't get me wrong. I like, who's the guy that played Khan?
Benedict Cumberbatch.
I like him, but for Khan? No way.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Exactly. It did not fit the mold.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And again, I like the remake's cast. And then, yeah, the other type that basically go, okay, we're going to play in this era. And we're going to add characters that didn't exist in that era. I don't know. Like, if we're going to use Star Trek, Discovery. I'm having flashbacks to Star Trek V with the main character. I don't actually have an issue with her per se.
Star Trek V, the search for Kirk's ego? Anyway,
Yeah. Like, I actually don't mind her as an actor. I think it's neat, but I think they're putting all their eggs in one basket, and suddenly Spock has a sister and a brother, apparently.
Mm.
Yeah.
And whereas I think I'd have less issues with the character if it had been a different family of Vulcans.
Yeah, because that makes no fucking sense to me.
Yeah.
Again, you know, I think that's the, you know, in terms of canon, that's always the trouble when you modify canon, no matter whether you're doing it, the game maker itself is doing it, or is yourself. It's like, well, how far do you stray, and will it be palatable? I don't think acceptable. Palatable is probably the better word to like your players, because you're like, you know, I understand. You know, there are people who are like, hey, I'm, you know, you have the encyclopedia people that unfortunately, at a certain level, you still have to placate.
Mm-hmm. They buy your books.
Well, I'm just saying, even in a personal game. You know, like your own personal game. If you have someone who's an encyclopedia, I know it sounds like, oh, I have to pander to my audience. But no, you have to at least, you know, they have to have buy-in. They have to be like, okay, I know it's not going to be exactly the world, but how much are you going to change? You know, I'll take it, for instance, where we were playing a Star Trek, an old-fashioned Star Trek game, where we were playing Klingons, of all things, which, you know, it was great. But the guy that was running it was heavily influenced by Star Wars, so there's just all of a sudden more and more started to be Star Wars elements appearing in the game.
Yeah.
And after a while, you're just like, I'm done. This is not the game I want to play. You know, mm-hmm. I don't want. I'm a Klingon, not some sort of weird Force user.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense here. But yeah, no, I'm just thinking here because ultimately, like, we bring back Forgotten Realms, but one of the things I will give Forgotten Realms credit for, when they redo an edition, they often go big or go home. Like, in second edition, they had a god show up on the planet, and basically half the gods get schmucked. An entire class got destroyed.
Yes.
An entire
that
class?
Was so
I'm
funny.
I'm not familiar. Which class was that?
Oh, the assassin.
Yeah, like, anyone who is literally, if on their character sheet or their stat block, they were listed as an assassin, they were dead, irrevocably.
Because Baal basically absorbed them all, from what I just remember. And different gods rose, different gods fell. It wasn't the same one pre-second edition, post-second edition. And then they did the other one, which is, of course, in fourth edition, where they did it, they advanced to 80 years, did the spell plague, blew up the world again, to the point where when they did fifth edition, they basically had to stuff everything back in the bottle.
Yeah.
And
they, like, fourth edition, they brought back a whole new continent, and then they got rid of it for fifth edition, which is really funny.
Oh, absolutely. Like, dude.
You know,
one of the few good
I mean, this is just me, but it's like, I couldn't imagine being one of the longer aged races if that was a real world.
My guess is he'd probably be the equivalent of, well, back in my day, we had assassins. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Honestly, I think if I was in that setting, I'd be like, you know what? I'm going to hold up here and just smoke weed till I'm dumb for the rest of eternity.
Yeah, because I remember a time when there was 10th level spells.
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that.
And again, there's a lot of that weird esoteric stuff. Like, and I will give them credit because they really tried to loosen it up. This is one of the reasons why they stopped publishing modules. They basically say the Resundering they set is basically a set point. They're basically leaving it alone and saying, whatever you want to bring back, you can. That's what the GM's Guild is for, but we're only going to bring back certain amounts, and results may vary.
Yeah. You know, well, this is where it gets real. This, stuff like that gets interesting, because I'll give you a good example. Traveler, for the longest time, has been had this concept of IMTU, which is in my Traveler universe. No, I'm serious. It's been around for a long time. You look up some of the early Traveler message groups. That's like something people used to put, you know, when they would write stuff. Sometimes they'd go like, in my Traveler universe. And that's one of the weird things about Traveler that I've always found fascinating, is that there's canon, but it's always been accepted to deviate, because it's like, it's almost acceptable because of the size of Traveler, that they're like, a size of the universe. Well, everyone's interpretation is going to slightly vary. And you know what? We embrace that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always been that. And I think that's what, I think that's what draws me to the Traveler's universe, is that, hey, there's lots of slightly different interpretations. You know, some people, hey, the scout service, you know, is popular, but, oh, and some people, you know, the Imperium is a benevolent benefactor, and some people it's an oppressive government. You know, take your pick, depending on what you want to do. But events in Traveler still have happened in the order in which they happened. It's just your interpretation of certain things have changed, and people are okay with that. And I find that fascinating, that, you know, here's a game that embraces the fact that people are going to interpret it differently. And yet then you have other games where it's just like, there's just not enough material to, you know, it's like sometimes I think some of the material in some games are a little too rigid, so there's not really a lot to interpret.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely. Like, one of the things I kind of am glad what they did with Eberron is they basically set a set date, which all games begin from, and they're never going to advance the timeline. Because they're working under the assumption that here's what the world is, here's your set block, do what you will, we're never going to change it.
Well, see, that, you know, and that's actually fascinating, because there's a lot of games that's always the problem. It's like, well, how do you run these things? Obviously, they solved it by saying all games will always start at effectively year zero.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, if you advance, you go through the modules this way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there are modules.
And another question I have that's kind of a weird one. How much of the fans affect canon? Like, probably the most recent one I can think of is Cobalt Press did their show Midgar, which basically got cobbled together with their different things. It's basically, you know, their version of D&D, which is actually really amazing. But when they did the next edition, they basically advanced the timeline by 10 years. But then they got a lot of feedback from people and different artists and illustrators. They got a lot of quality people to basically rewrite canon and to advance the storyline. And then when they released the new edition for 5th edition, it's not the same world. But is that the equivalent of 2nd edition blowing up the world? And how much should you get customer feedback to change canon? Hmm. Or how much do you ignore it?
I don't know, that's a tough one.
Yeah, ultimately, what you really need in a situation like that, anytime you have a setting to where there are all kinds of moving parts and everything needs to kind of make cohesive sense, you need someone, some kind of a guru, that's going to make sure that they all the pieces fit together. I know that, obviously, with the Forgotten Realms, they had Ed Greenwood, and he's actually passed the torch on to some other people who are kind of like the keepers of the lore, and they know how and why and where everything in Forgotten Realms is. And you see that in other settings. I think Cobalt Press does a pretty good job of making sure that everything kind of fits together in that same way. But one of my rented mules, so to speak, one of the things I constantly harp on is with White Wolf, with most of their settings, really Exalted, which is where I spent so much of my time really in the last 10 years, was they did let their fans kind of dictate what was going on, and they didn't really hold to any kind of a vision, because they went from one developer to another, and they kind of let too many people put their hand in the stew, so to speak, and eventually things kind of were too wonky and not cohesive enough to where it didn't feel like an organic setting. It felt like something that people were tinkering with on the fly. And you got that a lot with series that were extremely fan driven. On the opposite side of that, I would say a game like Warhammer 40K, boy, those people treat like all of those novels and history and what have you like a Bible. Like, mm-hmm. You want to see some fanatic fans. I guess that's a double negative, but you want to see some people who are so extremely dedicated to the canon of a game. It's Warhammer 40K fans, and they will not deviate. They will not budge an inch on, oh, you can't have female space marines, and you can't go this direction with it or that direction, and this planet in this cluster is definitely this way. And they seem to enjoy it. There's nothing wrong with that, but that's kind of that extreme end of things where whoever is in charge of the Warhammer 40K specifically, and I'm sure there are other examples, they keep a very good, or they spend a lot of time and do a very good job on making sure that that setting is well established and that it is well respected. And more power to them. If I could find someone to do that with any given setting, I'd be more than happy to do so.
Yeah. Well, fans have always been a double-edged sword. You mm-hmm. want them, but you got to be careful with them.
Oh, yeah.
And I got a friend of mine who actually has a little bit of a Warhammer story. I don't know if he'll ever be on, so I'll tell part of it. Long story short, as a small child, he went into one of the games workshops with Lego figures and wanted to play with them. Yeah, if you ever wanted to see people making, I don't know, sour faces, that was your feeling.
Yeah, I've heard of that. I've heard of that. Really, you can't view that army unless you actually have the miniatures. Well, go fuck yourself. Right. That's my opinion on that one. Well, you know, it's just like, you know, obviously Game Workshops hates people who, they were really big fans of banning the people who were generating miniatures on 3D printers.
Yeah.
Well, let's face it. I have some weird sticking point. I don't play, obviously, Warhammer. Either Warhammer, Warhammer 40K, or any of that. But I have issues with Games Workshop and some of their attitudes on things. Like, we're suing everybody over the word Space Marine. We own it. You fucking That's don't. Ridiculous. I don't care what the judge said.
Yeah, let's just say that's a term I've heard back in the early 40s in a public domain material, but yeah. I understand you're trying to get a different context. But then they're defending their canon, because in copyright law, yeah. if you don't defend it, you lose it.
Yep.
Which, by the way, is why Mickey Mouse is actually not trademarked, but copyrighted.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, and on top of
that. And, which is why... the Disney company is the purveyor of always pushing back how long copyright exists. They're one of the major people who push legislation, at least in the U.S., to extend copyright more and more and more.
Yep.
I believe it, because even though they get other material and basically run other stuff, that's their story, even if they kind of stole totally from, well, public folklore and basically made it their own brand.
Well, I was thinking specifically of like some of their characters like Mickey Mouse.
Oh, absolutely. Right.
That Steamboat Willie cartoon is like the focal point of all of that, and they keep pushing it back like 2 years at a time.
Right.
With that copyright specifically, and they'll lose it eventually, I presume, unless they change something drastic. But specifically, the Mickey Mouse in Steamboat Willie will then be public domain, but only that Mickey Mouse.
Right.
Yeah. What's even funnier is there's actually cartoons, because this is before the Walt Disney, before Snow White. There were actually 20s and 30s and 40s cartoons that were essentially knockoffs of Mickey Mouse before they had their copyright, you know, pretty much entrenched before they became a great empire.
Oh, yeah.
And it's kind of funny watching some of these cartoons that are basically off-brand Mickey Mouse's. But that's just a personal taste. You'll have to look it up via the internet. You'll find it.
Yeah, cartooning is a dirty, dirty business. Those people were awful to each other.
Yeah.
And still are to a degree.
Well, again, you find a business, you find out how the sausage is made, you might not want to eat the sausage.
Exactly.
But speaking of sausage, I have to use my own personal white whale, the one that basically broke an entire universe for me. Of course, I'm talking about Riff's Siege of Tolkien.
Oh, my God.
I have to, because this is canon. This is from the word's mouth. This is a meta plot.
Good point.
And it literally is the game that broke me as a Riffs fan.
And me too. I gave up on that company immediately after that.
Because they tell a great... I could go into my full rant, but I actually did it on my blog. I'll just hit the Cole's Notes points. What theme would you give a war movie? Underdogs fighting a great empire. So naturally, you paint the underdogs as the bad guys. Or show the city, well, it's burning for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Or all these stupid magical tricks that should have sort of worked somewhat, that were acknowledged but also not acknowledged in the actual meta plot. Or the ultimate deus ex machina, where you walk through a bug swamp of alien bugs known as Zytictics that basically eat everybody, but because they didn't fight back, they managed to sneak an army into the middle of Tolkien. Yeah. Like, that's just the high points. If you check I got it on my blog if you guys want to look at it, but long story short, canon badly written can break a game outright.
It's a textbook case.
I don't believe
that
at all.
It's a textbook case of how to do metaplot wrong. Mm-hmm. And they did, it was almost like they were ticking off a checklist, and they got every single thing they could have gotten wrong. And they just pissed off every fan. They didn't make the people who liked either side happy. And they just kind of pushed forward this narrative that was... like it was the wrong time period, and I'm not talking about in the game, I'm talking about like for our era. Like, this is the kind of narrative that you would see in a Flash Gordon comic from back in what is Flash Gordon, like 30s 40s. It was this kind of four color cornball, like, oh, the good guys win out even though the good guys are fascists apparently. Mm-hmm. And it was all very just very hackneyed and poorly done.
Yeah, not disagreeing here. But And there are games that require a huge amount of buy-in to the canon in order to play them, but it doesn't make them bad.
Well,
like, I guess the best example I can think of is Legend of the Five Rings. Basically, it is, if you have buy-in, it's one of the best games in that genre. But if you don't have buy-in, you won't want to touch it with a 30-foot pole.
I was just thinking, you know, and generally speaking, I guess it technically is canon, but, you know, there's a lot of games that you have to know the setting to really play it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there are a lot of games like that, and you're just like, and I think that's how I get sometimes with fantasy games, where I'm just like, you know, as much as it sucks, there's a reason that the D&D vanilla fantasy, as I will call it, is popular, because everyone can grasp that, even if it's not really exciting.
Mm-hmm. But we have common cultural knowledge. Right. And especially, like, as much as we think, you know, Lord of the Rings is the foundation it's based on, Gary drew on a lot of sources to make D&D what it is. And the fact that we got three really good movies in the, well, early 2000s out of it, you know, Lord of the Rings, which is a story in itself. It's funny, you know, people know the tropes, people know the things. People, you don't need to say what an RPG is anymore, because we've been there, done that. You know, either you played in a video game, or you watch a movie, or you watch a podcast where people watch you play video, you know, play an RPG nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
So I would argue that in today's era, you don't need to explain what an RPG is unless you do something radically different. Not to the same level.
Easier. Yeah.
And sometimes, even when you explain it, whatever you're doing, it doesn't quite make... It's one of those weird things. It's like, did I get rid of Mouse Guard? I think I did. I had the Mouse Guard RPG. And for whatever reason, I read the rules and I'm like, you know, I played a lot of RPGs. I don't think I quite got a grasp on what the hell they're talking about. You know, but it's weird because I met other people that have never really played RPGs, and it's like they grasp, you know, it almost intuitively. And you're just like, that's fucking weird that I've played RPGs all my life and I don't understand what the fuck they're talking about. But apparently, if you've never played an RPG, it makes perfect sense.
I'm not disagreeing here. Like, there are two games that I honestly think the instruction could be written a little better, but they're fantastic games in their own right. Fate and Apocalypse World.
Mm.
If you don't go in with a good GM who knows what the heck they're talking about, those games could go very disastrously. And those are two games that I would argue really need a session zero more than any other, you know, more crunchy games.
Well, yes. Definitely the Apocalypse World or any of the settings based on it. Being like, you know, let's face it. Take what's the one game that I own? Tremulous. Well, the choices you make actually set up the game world, so you have to have a session zero.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I believe Apocalypse World and all its other derivatives are pretty much the same way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you've heard my rant on that, so I will leave it at that. But generally speaking, I'm not sure what else to add as far as canon's concerned. Do you guys have any ideas?
I was going to add a kind of saying about the like the podcasts. We're kind of lowering the bar of entry because people are being more familiar with what role-playing games are. And you're right. It comes from from video games that use all the terminology like hit points and attributes and so on. Mm-hmm. But on that note, and speaking specifically to canon, I think the Tal'Dorei campaign for Dungeons and for fifth edition fantasy, if you will, which was born from the Critical Role campaign. If you're familiar with that Matt Mercer game, he created a whole game world, partially like him making up the ideas and then taking like player input and kind of, you know, putting together a patchwork. So many people enjoyed that he then put out a campaign book with, I think it was Green Ronin. And that's, to me, that's a really cool example of canon making the game rather than the game making canon. It's kind of taking something. It's not even really a license or a licensed game like some are. Like, it's not a Lord of the Rings role-playing game or a Doctor Who role-playing game, but it's really kind of this weird, organic, almost how if you would imagine Greyhawk came to be, where it's like it was just Gary's campaign and started slapping things together and saying, okay, we're going to make this game world and we're going to make it cohesive. I think that's really cool. And I think they did something really cool with the canon there, where they've taken the people who are playing the game and let them really kind of make their mark on the game world. And I think even some fans have been able to have some input on it, if I'm not mistaken. But obviously, they've been very careful about not making sure that it kind of loses the thread there.
No, that makes perfect sense here. I can argue I've had a similar methodology. A buddy of mine has run the thing, one of my most favorite games of all time, but he used a system that really shouldn't work, but it does because of the genre. He'd been playing a game called Cartoon Action Hour, and the game we're playing is essentially an 80s cartoon called Nisenshi Go, or as I like to call it, Space Ninjas. And yes, it's on the website. It's on my own Twitch channel, which I commonly go on Sundays. I ain't going to mention it here. But it's truly one of the greatest and most surreal experiences I think I ever had, because I get to relive all those horrible 80s cartoons in a way that's new, because we keep drawing on the various things, including public service announcements at the end.
Oh, God. Nice. I'm sorry, all of a sudden I'm just doing flashbacks of, G.I. Joe used to have all those weird public service announcements.
And that's exactly what happens.
Somewhere, somebody has, created whole new, talks to Matt lip sync the movement. And you're just like, it's just like, wow. Someone did a lot of drugs and came up with this. It's hilarious, but jeez.
Well, dude, it was even before the era of YouTube, and that tells you how dedicated they were for making these things.
It goes to show
that the people who watched the G.I. Joes and the He-Mans and what have you grew up with kind of a twisted sense of humor.
I'm not disagreeing, because honestly, even though they're not the greatest quality, every so often it's a guilty pleasure.
Yeah.
To the point where me and my buddies, every so often, we have a random 80s table. Like, when we're feeling, okay, we're not sure what to do. Okay, we're rolling on the table. And, yeah, stuff has come out that's just, okay, we remember why we stopped watching this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I won't say it's a guilty pleasure, but definitely one of my favorite cartoons from the, I guess it is. I mean, was definitely, in terms of an 80s cartoon, it wasn't a pot. I mean, it only had, maybe a season. I don't think it was more than a season. Was the old Thundar the Barbarian.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing. That thing is amazing.
Well, let's face it. I mean, not that he actually did actual work on it, but he did all the original sketches for it, was Jack Kirby.
Yep. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it shows in all that stuff. And it's just like, you look at some of the characters and you're like, wow. You can see is that influence of that in other characters that he did elsewhere, and you're just like, Jesus. So that was always a fun one. And that's one of those ones that I think there's been several people who have made Thundar the Barbarian RPGs, obviously not official.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always been one that's like, wow, yeah, that would be fun to do.
Yeah. No, my personal thing about the TV show is they always did it in a different city, and if you look, you can see the ruins of where it is. Like, when you go to St. Louis, you see the broken arch.
Right.
And it's one of those stupid things that somebody I was on a podcast with, who does this amazing stuff about the post-apocalypse, he brought it to my attention. And it's like getting the blinders taken away from your eyes, which is also canon.
Right.
It's that little extra bit of nugget of information that makes something more enjoyable, because you're in the know.
Right.
And, I don't know what else to say.
Well, my last comment before we get to the Kickstarters is it involves canon, licensed properties of literary canon.
Okay.
Which is, again, one of these things that obviously players have to know and buy in, whereas it's like, you've read all the books, be it you know, whatever the hell it is, be it obviously Lord of the Rings, be it every single Underdark novel with Drizzt.
Yeah, fair enough.
It's a fucking story. And obviously when you're making, want to make a game out of it, there has to be changes.
Yep.
And I think that's the biggest hurdle with any property that's that any RPG that's based off of a licensed property, be it Star Wars, Star Trek, I don't care what it is. I don't care if it's freaking Tremors.
Mm-hmm.
Those are obviously, that's the source material, but that doesn't necessarily make a great game.
I got two stories to build on that.
Yeah. So,
one, a cautionary tale. One, basically, that became a way of life. Okay. I've been an anime fan for a long time. I've seen all sorts of good stuff. I've seen all sorts of bad stuff. But if we're mentioning gaming, we cannot mention gaming and anime without Guardians of Order. This was a company that ran D20 stuff back in the day to varied results, and I'm not going to talk about how they collapsed horribly, but what I will mention is whenever they got a license, there was only so much they could do with it. Like, they got the Trigun license, but only could do so much with Trigun. It's got, you know, Planet Gunsmoke. Because they were forced to follow the canon. And as a result, it's hard to basically gamify an environment. Whereas, for all the faults of George, this is why I have a lot of respect for the man, he let gamers run wild in his world to the point where it's affected canon and in the Star Wars universe. So,
there is an argument that there would have never been any additional movies without the extended Star Wars universe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's the novels, whether it's the fact that a lot of ships didn't get canonized until it should have been a decent role-playing game, or...
Well, let's just take... Actually, there are some people that would argue that there would be no additional Star Wars material without the West End Games version of Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had to answer a lot of questions about background and how things worked. And so, ironically, those books became the canon for the Star Wars universe in a weird way. Now, that has changed over the years, but initially, many ways, those books, which were a game, an interpretation of the Star Wars movies, effectively became the core canon, which other things were based off of, even though they eventually changed a lot of that stuff.
Yeah. So, I will bring up the other example of the exact opposite response. Rolemaster Middle-earth role-playing, for all its faults, went through everything. They went through the unfinished works, they explained things, they defined things. As soon as Christopher Tolkien got back the license, he walked a lot of what they wrote down back. Like, he got the names of the two blue wizards, which were only written in the unfinished notes. And then, therefore, Christopher does not consider them canon, so that's why they keep making the joke whenever they're involved in any other medium. They don't give them names.
Yeah, well, let's face it, Rolemaster and that the whole token license, that was a big, weird, fucking mess.
Oh, absolutely.
You know.
But I will throw this out to anybody who's creating content. Allow people to play in your universe, but make sure they know what the hell they're doing.
Yep.
All right, well, enough of that. Should we get to the Kickstarters?
Sure.
And close out this thing? Because I'll tell you what I found interesting is there were two superhero role-playing games in this whole section. Did you guys...
Oh, they seem to be making a comeback.
Which, don't get me wrong. I like superhero role-playing games, but I just think it's fascinating. So, first up, we had the Super Age role-playing game, which... at this point has actually made its money, which, you know, again, I like superheroes. Right now it's $12 just to get the PDF. So that might be something to look at. I don't know. I find superhero games I like the idea of them, but I'm never quite sure what to do with them. If that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
It does indeed.
You know, and I think, it's because I've seen what's happened, especially with games like Champions. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's an interpretation of what superpowered people can do in your in a particular universe, and it doesn't mean you can make any superhero. I don't care what the rules say. Which can be attested to is if you've ever read, seen the, all, some of the old like people doing, I made Superman and champ in the Champions rules, and he's 5,000 points, and you're like, that's great. Or, you know, obviously Green Lantern or Batman or take your pick. They're always really super. It's like, well, and they would always argue, well, that's because they have a lot of experience. I'm like, okay, that's great. I get that, but it's a fun exercise, but that's about as far as I take it. So, again, it's kind of interesting, you know, a superhero game. I actually find this other one that's listed, which is it a plane? A comic book RPG that replaces dice with pins. Apparently, you.
Oh, my.
Apparently, you draw as part of the game. And stick figures is okay. You don't have to draw well because you have a certain amount of time. I find that vastly more interesting. I don't know exactly how it plays, but that's interesting to me. That they have this mechanic to resolve things that I guess you're drawing the cut sequences or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I like this. It says, but they because they have this title. But I can't draw. If you mean you draw bad, if you're bad at drawing, worry not, true believer. In the limited time to draw that all players have, even artists that create hastily drawn images that may occasionally be misinterpreted. If you can draw crude stick people and wonky squares that are supposed to be houses, then it will do just fine.
Borderline! Yay!
The more you play, the more you will find easy ways to communicate what you're doing to the editor, in parentheses, game master. You may also get better at drawing at the speed when playing a campaign. This game could also be used to learn or relearn how to draw. And there's a potential to draw for young players and for people that may benefit from physical therapy. Anyway, I just thought...
Oh, wow!
I'm just saying, as a concept, that is definitely more interesting than any superhero game I've actually heard in a long time.
That's like the highest concept role-playing game I think I've ever heard, period.
Yeah, so, it's made the list.
It is it's $11 US for the PDF. And they've not reached their goal, which is a shame.
Yeah.
They have 24 days to go. I almost feel like I should back it just to see if they make it.
Well, you get to a point where certain ones you think they're lost causes, but you like to throw in a couple of shekels because, well, again, we like Kickstarters on this show. We just can't afford all of them because otherwise we'd all be in the poorhouse.
But definitely as a concept for a game, I have to give this one, I don't know how the drawing works or how well it works, but definitely as a concept, I give that one an approval just because that is definitely the most interesting mechanic I think I've seen in a long fucking time.
Yeah.
So. All right, let's move on. hell, let's just start at the other side. We have, obviously, Dangerous Descents, 5th edition. I love this. A collection of lethal, gaxy, and one-shot 5th edition D&D adventures. Designed to be easy to run and not hard to forget. And obviously they reached their goal already. What were they? This is another one out of England because the last one was from England because it was originally in pounds. And so you can get all four adventures for about $16 US.
That's not bad. You see, more should be that priced, but I'm kind of a frugal Kickstarter shopper, so I might just be a jerk about it.
Definitely with adventures. I have... My personal rule nowadays is I will have the physical copy of the main rule book, but everything else, in my opinion, I can do in a PDF.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, you know, especially adventures. You know, if I need the adventure, yeah. I will print it out and recycle.
Right.
So. Mm-hmm.
Well, you still got it on your hard drive, so it's not exactly like you're losing anything.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm already looking at trying to rip a whole bunch of DVDs and throw away the DVDs.
Storage, my eternal foe.
Well, it's just physical space versus not so physical.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, it's one of those tricks of the mind where, you know, it's kind of like, you know, you've always played the, you know, obviously like MMOs where I have this item. Interestingly enough, in your mind, even though that object does not physically exist, it lights up the same part of your brain as if you had the physical object. Did you know that?
Mm-hmm. I've heard something similar.
And yep. People go like, well, how does that work? Well, it's like, well, let's face it. Do you have money? Yeah, where's your money? It's in the bank. Well, same concept. You know? The money doesn't physically exist in your hands, but you know you have it.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting part of the human psyche. That's how that works. And which is why people will pay real money for imaginary objects. All right.
Yeah.
So next up we have Agents of Concordia, the RPG, to take a role in an agent traveling between worlds in this action mystery fantasy pen and paper RPG set in alternate 1960s. Wow, that's a mouthful.
Indeed. I'm just reading over it now.
It sounds neat. I think we're coming around to the point where a lot of these set pieces, these historical set pieces, have kind of come around. You get things like Mad Men and Boardwalk Empire, and people are really kind of looking at the past and realizing that they're not just like these corny pictures in old newspapers, that they were actually kind of living and breathing interesting times.
Well, yeah. And I think this is why, especially even in my fantasy games, I'm not a big fan of the high fantasy. I know that sounds weird, but it's like I have a disconnect with that. It's like I prefer the mid to low fantasy because it's almost feel for me, it feels like something I can touch. It's like, you know.
Yeah.
It's like I prefer my fantasy to be more feudal rather than Renaissance era because there's just something about it. I mean, one of the reasons I got into D&D initially is I had this interest in medieval life. I had an interest in knights. I had an interest in squires. I had an interest in castles and things like that where, you know, you, especially when I started playing D&D, those were very fundamental to D&D.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you've progressed into D&D, it's gotten to be a lot more high fantasy and a lot more, I always tell people the tech got a lot more Renaissance era, and I'm just like, you're losing me.
Fair enough.
So
you know, I'm getting flashbacks for this by looking at the pictures. It's reminding me of BioShock.
That makes sense.
It could be, you know, that's where they based that off of. So this,
you know,
game
with the heavy dose of Metropolis of all things.
I'm not sure where the SEK. Is that Swedish? No, right? SEK. What's that monitor?
I think it is. Here, well, easy way to find out. We have the internet.
Is it like Swedish kroner or something?
Yeah, I think so. Yep, the Swedish krona.
Swedish krona. You got her. Well done,
there
Ish.
You go. Yeah, so it's from Sweden. So it'll be interesting to have. Obviously, I'm guessing there's an English. It's an English translation. So that'll be interesting how the English, because anytime you translate from one language to another, my hat's off to anyone who does translations.
Agree completely.
So, all right, let's get on with A Delve in the Cave, 5th Edition Adventure. Obviously another adventure. It has 7 days to go. It still needs about $700.
Yeah, doable.
So again, I'm a big fan of, hey, if you can get adventures on the cheap that are PDF format, get them.
Well, again, ever since we had our good buddy on the show, wasn't Mike, he really did open our eyes of how much you push to get these little adventures out and how much a little adventure goes a long, long way, considering it's only like 32 pages.
Right.
And it's just a quick plug and play. You want it, you got it. You want to support the little guy.
Yeah.
And this gives them a chance to try something out that he might not normally be able to do. Like, let's find out what he actually, I'm looking at the people and he's really well organized. You know, well, you can see good. He has his team lined up. He's got his thing organized. He's got a group shot.
That's important. So
yeah, like, I'd be blunt. Maybe I'm in a weird mood today, but it looks like all these things are being bloody appealing today. Got to be careful.
Yep. Okay, so next up we have the Otherworld and Beyond 13H RPG Planner Adventures. So I've never really played 13th Age. Either one of you guys have?
I got the books, but honestly, I really haven't played it yet.
Yeah, okay. Well,
I've got a passing familiarity with it. They seem to have really done they took all the best parts, allegedly. I haven't played it, so I don't know. They took the best parts of 4th edition Dungeons & Dragons and Pathfinder and kind of mixed them together, and it seems people who play it are really happy with it. And I think it's abstracted enough. It kind of does away for the of with the need of any kind of miniatures, which I think is a good thing. And they have a way of making combat go quickly. And that's just hearsay, but I've been intrigued. I've been interested in trying it out sometime, but not enough hours in the day, obviously.
Well, yeah, there never is. And,
like, right. I think it's safe to assume if we played a game a day for the rest of our lives, we still die probably before we got through half of them.
I agree.
But yeah, like, one of the things I always liked about 13th Age is the idea of icons, where instead of having Elminster as the guy who takes your plot line away, he's actually influencing the plot. You know, whether it's the mages, the orc chief, etc. And you kind of work your way around these icons and how you play off them.
There's one thing that I want to steal from 13th Age, and that's that every character has one unique thing. It's like literally on their character sheet, and you have to write something that's unique about your character. And it could be like, I'm the only person who met the Oracle before she died, or, you know, I was marked by the passing comet, and so that's part of my destiny or something. And mm-hmm. so everybody has to think about how they incorporate into the setting, even if it's just some kind of quirky one-line note that it kind of ties you to the setting. And that's something I think I want to try for one of my coming up games.
Oh, agree completely. So the Kickstarter itself is basically includes a whole bunch of towns and gates and a whole nine yards. They've already made their money, so it's just a matter of whether you want it or not.
Yeah.
And it looks great. Like, I'm a sucker for maps, and they have a city map, even if it's very symmetrical. And,
all right.
Looks like they've already unlocked one of their stretch goals, so I guess if they know what they're doing, I look forward to seeing the results.
I'm going to skip this next one. Unfortunately, I'm only saying that just because, well, they have 17 days to go, and they've only made $536 out of a $10,000 goal.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So I'm going to skip that. Sorry, guys. Next up, we have the Viking R, a D6 Viking RPG. You know, this is funny. I think in the last year, I've seen at least two or three Kickstarters that involve Vikings. They have 26 days to go. They were only asking for $814. So
we got time, but at the same time,
It's about $7 for the PDF. So that's
well, I like their picture. Like, you know, they have the Vikinger right there, and I have to admit that's one hell of a picture. So I'll give them full kudos for that.
Yeah. I mean, this is, again, one of those things that, it could be cool for a few bucks just to own.
Yeah. Oh, indeed. And again, Vikings are one of the iconic settings when you don't play straight medieval. Them and the ancient Egyptians, which we will get to one day.
Exactly. So next we have Interbellum RPG, War Adventures and a World of Techno Magic. And they're at 2/3 of the way to their goal. They got about 22 days to go. I mean, I do like their... At least their main picture, you know, obviously it looks like it's World War I based.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I like the pencil drawing that they have below it, which is kind of cool.
Oh, indeed. That is a very, I guess, I don't know what you'd call it because it's not steampunk, but it has that feel.
It's pretty close. I mean, That's why they called it, what did they call it? Techno magic, so
yeah.
So it's steampunk after the Victorian era, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Is the way I describe it. They let's see, cost wise, $15 for the PDF, and $25 for the PDF of that, and then the art book. They have an art book that they're going to do. Wow, that's interesting.
Well, to be fair, the art looks great, so. You know, maybe they could justify it, but they do it right.
What I find interesting is that none of this is being sold with a physical copy.
That's unusual.
Everything's PDF, what I'm looking at. I don't see a pledge level that has a physical copy.
Yeah, you got a point there.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and they actually sold out of both their the two big pledges, you know, the limited ones. So kudos.
Yeah.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, I mean, there was only like 300 T backers each, but that's cool.
No, and that's actually smart because he's not going to break the bank if something goes wrong.
Right.
You know, if he succeeds enough to actually succeed, but not enough to actually, you know, like... Sorry, go on.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I think people are getting smarter about kickstarting. Like, it's a skill now.
Yeah.
It's definitely something I don't have.
Yeah.
Well, first off, I don't think even if I wanted to run a Kickstarter, I don't think I'd have the willpower to do it.
Mm-hmm. No.
Yeah, I came to a weird insight a couple of weeks ago. I think I told Ish this off camera. Your first Kickstarter should be small. Mm-hmm. Do it as small as possible. Do it to the absolute bit because they're more likely to throw a couple of bucks in there. Like, I would limit it to 30 to 32 pages, you know, at most. And I keep it as a non-hard copy because that way you can learn the tricks of the trade in a way that's not going to break the bank if something goes drastically wrong.
Exactly.
Well, and please, for the love of God, finish half of what you're doing before you even start the Kickstarter. Like, yeah. Do not kickstart and then begin work because that's just going to be heartbreak.
You should be as close as physically possible before you run a Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you're going to lose the heat you generated from the Kickstarter when you give the product. It'll be 2 years later and you say, hey, I got a book.
Yep.
And then it goes on the shelf and then you forget about it.
That's the best case scenario. The worst case scenario, you've got people hounding you for a product throughout that entire process. And if you think you hate writing a book and feeling unappreciated about it, try writing a book and feeling, you know, straight up harassed about it, which... I get it's not like I'm saying that it's unwarranted, but oh man, I've been peripherally involved in too many Kickstarters that have been that way, and it's not a good feeling. I almost physically lost sleep over stuff like that.
Oh, ouch.
Yeah.
That's yeah.
So speaking of someone who is vastly familiar with Kickstarters, we have Parkheim Gods Second Edition from Eloy LaSanta. So
I'm familiar with the original. I'm kind of curious to see. Wow, it got funded in just 7 hours.
Yeah. He was asking for $5,000. He's at a little over, almost at 15. And he still has 26 days to go. So that's cool.
I'm actually kind of curious about this thing and the situation here because this is actually one of the most intriguing superhero campaigns I've ever heard of, where you're basically playing a demigod, but you still got to make rent.
Yeah,
and that balance between the two, like, it reminds me of like anime is like The Devil is a Part-Timer, where you're technically a fundamentally incredibly powerful being, but you still got to deal with the trials and tribulations of everyday life.
Yes.
So $20 gets you the PDF and wallpaper.
Nice.
And then $50 for the PDF, the print, and the wallpaper. So
Well, I ain't going to lie to you. I'm intrigued, but it's getting the 24-hour rule on this one.
I have to say, so far, the only one that I've really considered as a possibility is the drawing one so far. And that's only because that's just so weird and unique. I almost want to fund it just to see how it really works.
And cheap. It's not very expensive.
Right, exactly. You know, it's like, if it doesn't hold up, it's like, eh. It was fun. So next up we have...
People are more willing to part with their money when it's only like $5.
Yeah. Heroes of Estaria, a fantasy tabletop RPG. They actually reached their goal.
Nice.
Hooray.
So their PDF is $15. One consumable item, just I don't understand. Okay, hold on. I don't understand how this is working. Include your name in the Hall of Steward, one community chest item. I don't get how this is working.
Is it a loot box style thing?
I don't.
It would be weird if they did that as a Kickstarter.
Yeah, it's just.
Sorry, Jeff, go on.
Yeah, I'm reading it, and the product viewed both the light and full version. Okay. And it doesn't look like the light version shows up until $60. And then $90 for the full version. The fuck is the... Okay, that's a weird... I don't... That's an expensive game.
I'm looking at it, and I think I know what happened. They made a box set.
Hmm.
Like, you look at the picture, and you could tell they made it... It looks cool. And I'm glad they made their money. But... I'm just thinking of shipping.
I see. So that's what it is. So, yeah. Okay. Not interested. Next. Oh. All right. So next up we have Creatures of Vathis, Volume 1 for D&D 5th Edition. So obviously if you need more creatures, there you go.
Cool.
And I love this. It's... D&D 5th Edition, but the Pathfinder is a stretch goal.
Huh.
Okay. And have they reached their...
Well, and it makes me wonder, with Pathfinder 2 coming out soon, is that even... Will people even want that?
That's a tough one.
Yeah, that's probably the problem here is, like, since they reported Pathfinder 2nd Edition, I think a lot of people are going to just wait and see, unless he's going to update it to the 2nd Edition version.
Oh, man, that's a can of worms right there.
Yeah,
because right now there's a lot of people who are waiting in anticipation. Like, I have total faith in Lisa Stevens being able to keep the company alive, considering how many miracles she's managed to pull off in her history. But I got to wait and see.
All right.
I would be interested in doing a show about that.
Oh?
Yeah, about Pathfinder 2. I mean, I think it's fascinating to think just everything to do with it, how it's affecting the third party, the third party publishers, and just how everybody's basically waiting on bated breath to see what happens next.
Hmm.
I will add that to the list. That's a good idea. I like it. We talked a little bit about it when it first came out, but honestly, that needs a deep dive if we're going to do it right.
Yeah, that's a tough one for me. That said, we have one last Kickstarter, the Savage Worlds Sovereign Stone, which is Larry Elmore's Sovereign Stone to the Pathfinder system. They were only asking for $678. They reached it, so I'm not quite sure. Again, a UK product. It's out of the UK. So the core rulebook is about $22 US for the PDF.
I am curious.
Yeah, because you can get...
Oh! Ha-ha! He got... Oh, good Lord. Did you see the names that are involved in this product? Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman.
Yeah. Kind of weird, huh?
Yeah. Wow. I am so glad to see Margaret Weiss's name. I was worried she was a little bit burned after the whole Marvel thing.
It's just cool to see people in, you know, still working in the industry that have been around that long. It almost seems like many of them have gone away, maybe forever, as far as just not wanting to come back.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Let's face it, the RPG gaming manufacturing industry is pretty rough.
It'll spit you out.
Yeah.
Well, again, these guys were involved in Castle Ravenloft and Dragonlance, and if there aren't any more iconic games than those in D&D, I don't know what they are.
Agreed.
And it's just the fact that they're still producing stuff makes me happy, but it's also kind of weird what they're producing here. So I don't know. Maybe it's just a weird tangent. But they made their money and then some. So I'm glad for them, and I'll be interested to see where it leads.
All right. Last up, we should talk about the Bundle of Holding.
Sure, okay.
Because there's some interesting choices here.
Mm-hmm.
There's Paranoia Classic that you can get for when the next week. And they are they're actually doing some 10% of their proceeds to the Human Rights Watch.
I love that's got to be a joke.
What?
The game that's basically designed to be the most... Well, it's Paranoia Man.
Right, I know. you gotta love how they applied their irony, I guess, is what you want to call it.
Oh, absolutely. Like, I might pick it up just for the sheer promo, but I'll see.
Well, it's interesting because for the initial one, for like just under $18, you can get Paranoia the First Edition. But if you bump it up to what is their second level? $27.21, you get the first edition and the second edition and a whole bunch of other stuff. So that's kind of cool. I know a lot of people that love Paranoia. I've seen the rule system. I read some of it. I just have never played it.
Yeah, and I'm seeing a name that's actually making me seriously consider it even more. Eric Wujek.
Oh, wow. Created
actually a module there, and I've been a fanboy pretty much my entire life of his products. So yeah, there's that.
All right. Okay. Next up, we have Hackmaster. So for 12-13, there's a whole bunch of stuff that you can get. You know, obviously the Player's Handbook. And if you bump it up to the next level, you can get that and the Game Master's Guide.
Yeah. This is one of those games I've always wanted to play, but I'm almost terrified to. Yeah. Does that make any sense? Because I am a fan of Jelly Blackburn and Dave Kanzer. Pretty hard one. I think they're the boys that made it, even though they're not boys anymore by any stretch of the imagination. And I was impressed as all hell when they got the license for the first and second edition, managed to make their own world, and then they blew it up and built a version that was more proprietary. I've never played the new system. I'm curious, but at the same time, you need the right group for that.
Right.
If it's anything like, which segues nicely into the next one.
Well, first off, want to say that they are 10% of their proceeds will go to Reading is Fundamental.
Nice.
I like reading. That's a good Kickstarter. Yep. I mean, good,
Yeah.
Thank you.
And obviously you're talking about the Knights of the Dinner Table bundle of holding.
Ooh-dee-hoo.
So, and again, they're actually, this again is funding Reading is Fundamental. It's from the same group that obviously did Hackmaster.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of cool. And last up is an interesting choice. Campaign Cartographer. Campaign Cartographer 3 and the Tomb of Ultimate Mapping for $30. And then if you spend $64.56, you also get Dungeon Designer 3, 11 style, symbol, and tool packs, and 2 battle map sets.
You know, I don't know if it's the day today, but this is actually something I wouldn't mind picking up for a relatively cheap price, because I got a friend of mine who does a good chunk of any maps I've ever done, and he's always fighting with the darn thing, but he also had to spend a lot more for it. Mind you, I think it's Campaign Cartographer 2.
Yeah.
I think I may have figured out somebody's birthday gift. I won't mention who it is.
Yeah. Oh, one other thing is that with each purchase, the routes are giving you a discount code good up through the end of May for 10% off of any additional purchase at the Pro Fantasy Software web store. So, and they are supporting water.org.
Wow.
Charity.
So. That's... I don't know if I'm in the mood or something, but this is probably the one that's... of all the things we've done that impresses me the most, because it's something that if you ever end up producing your own product, you could really use this. You know, whether that's you're putting your maps, your own ideas, your own icons, the community that's associated with this.
Yeah.
Like, if you're creating your module, this might actually fix one of my own problems. Thank you.
Yeah. So basically, the way they described it is for the $65 to get both the core collection and the bonus collection, for that $65, you get enough products that basically, if you add $136 to it, that's what its value is. So
I believe it. I've seen the prices.
You're looking at, for $65, you're getting about $200 worth of software.
Wow.
And that doesn't even account the fact that you're going to get the additional discount code for 10% off if you want to buy something additional before the end of the month's over.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's not a lot, but that's a few bucks.
Not disagreeing here. Wow.
I will only add this. My major problem with the Campaign Cartographer, it has the steepest learning curve on the planet.
Yeah, I can see that.
And I'm familiar with CAD software, and I find it difficult to use.
Yeah.
It definitely takes a lot of skill. It's one of those weird things. It's like, to get a really good map, it takes a lot of skill. You can do something pretty horrible, which looks okay.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a steep learning curve. It's like, you know, you really have to wrap your mind around layers and all this other stuff that is very CAD-centric. Because it's a CAD engine underneath.
Yeah.
That said, it's going to sound weird, but because of my GIS background, I'd almost rather have a GIS tool to do all these maps.
Well, we've talked in the past how we usually fall to the default of Hexographer, because that way it's really easy to do. You just put some hexes down,
right,
and you get your map within like 10 minutes or so.
And it doesn't look bad. I mean, it's perfectly workable and acceptable. And it's not that complex, and there is pay and free versions of it.
Yeah.
And he has Dungeonographer and all that other stuff. So, interestingly, they have Campaign Cartographer in Dungeon Designer 3, but they left out Cityographer. I mean, City.
Interesting.
City Designer. Which I guess for a lot of people it's not a big deal. City Designer has the weird add-on for doing buildings, you know, and it's really. It has this, at least the old version used to have this feature that you could turn on and you could draw a line and it would just generate a random string of buildings along that line.
Yeah.
So, kind of interesting. That said, it's weird because if you had Campaign Cartographer 3 and Dungeon Designer 3, I don't know how it is now, but it used to be with the two. If you installed Campaign Cartographer and then Dungeon Designer 2, and then you got City Designer 2, you had to install City Designer 2 and then reinstall Dungeon Designer 2.
Whoa. That's a little bit like a mess.
It's just the way that got updated. It's not a bad tool. But it definitely... I don't know. For the price, it might be worth it to check it out. At least, you know, for $30, you're getting a pretty good chunk of software for that. I mean, let's just... I'm curious right now what they're running on their... from their... Because right now, I don't want this on email. Campaign Cartographer by itself is running about $45.
Okay, so it's a discount for the stuff, but I'm sure there's lots of stuff here and there.
Tombs of Ultimate Mapping. Let's see what they. Tomb of. I don't know. Let's see what's on here. Where is it here? God, I hate this. I'm seeing it. It's on here, but I don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's in here. It says it's here. Where the hell is it highlighted?
Okay.
I don't see it. It's weird. It's like, I know it has to be on here. But obviously they have this Tomb of Ultimate. Oh, there it is. In the tomb. Okay, there we go. Tomb of Ultimate Mapping is $20. So when you add 20 plus 45, that's 65.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about half. And if you actually did 65, you'd get that plus Dungeon Designer plus that other stuff. So
yeah, you're going to get your money's worth out of it, even if you spend 5 minutes saying, I don't know what the hell I'm doing, I run away from it.
Yeah. And by the way, just a little over a week at the time that we record this, by the time it actually... post, so we've just about a week left.
Yeah.
All right, anything else before we get the hell out of here?
Well, I'll keep it simple. Any of our audience, tell us about your own experiences with Canon.
Yeah, and how much you actually deviate. And you can do that by sending us an email at info@rpgcircus.com. If you go to the RPG Circus homepage, there is a link to the voice, the SpeakPipe application. which will allow you to record a voicemail message and then we'll email it to us. I actually like that if you can. Anything else you want to add, Ish, or are you good?
No, I am good. Thank you.
All right. With that, we will go ahead and strike the tents, so to speak, and we will see everyone in just about 2 weeks.
See you then.
We'll see ya.
RPG Circus is released on a Creative Commons Attribution US License 3.0. For more information, please visit creativecommons.org.